recorder.
This is definitely going to be a talk that's, I guess the outline I had for this was, I've been to several meetings here where they tried to bring together two separate fields, often people that work on multidimensional black hole ideas, and then the astronomers. And the big thing that happens there is the astronomers immediately give a talk where they put in so much jargon that I don't even know what they're talking about, and I'm supposedly an astronomer. So I'm going to try and give this with as minimal jargon as I can, and I'm going to spend some time just defining the jargon, because I want everyone to, if you decide to go to some of our talks on the supernova gamma ray burst connection, I want you to at least know some of the acronyms, which astronomers like so much, what those acronyms mean. Our workshop is the supernova gamma ray burst connection, and the idea there was that we've been starting to get a lot of data where these two types of explosions, and I'm going to go into detail about both of them, have some ties. You can learn from one, you can learn about one from the other, and knowing both the similarities and differences tells you something about both of the mechanisms. So the idea was to bring together both fields and try and get some common ground from which we could grow off of what we already know. Cosmic explosions are things that we've had man has known about for over 2,000 years almost. The first real records come from the Chinese, and there's at least a good nice supernova in 185 AD. And at that time, the supernova meant, the supernova have always been things of change. They've caused people to do to realize they should change something. And at that time, it was actually a portent for an insurrection. So it was not a good thing to have. By 1006, it had gotten much better. So by 1006, the 1006 supernova in the Asian records, it was obvious. And there's this nice, people have studied the old records, Chinese records. The Chinese astrologer, astronomer at the time, said that this meant that there was a time of great prosperity. So it went from insurrection to prosperity. That was a good news. Nowadays, it doesn't mean as much in change as it did in the past. At least there's not kingdoms falling or rising based on a supernova. But it has changed careers. So in 1987, I'm going to give one example. I'll have lots of personal examples to make fun of people that are either here or not here. In this case, it's not here. Ewald Müller had a very promising career on the dark side, studying cosmology before 1987A came out, and he's turned to the light at that point, which may have hurt his career prospects, but at least he's doing good science now. And so it does change. I know of several people whose careers have been altered by at least 1987A supernova. The funny news is that his students who did not go to the light are now directors of Max Planck Institute. So maybe that's a good thing. He avoided being a director as well. So two bonuses for that. So these are explosions that we've known about for a long time. And what I want to do is give you guys a little bit of history of the two different explosions. I'm going to try and tie them together. I'll split them apart again. I'll try and bring them back together at the end to show you how these two types of explosions have really played a strong role. And most of what I'm going to do is just kind of basic descriptions of what's happening with supernovas. So maybe at the edges of this blackboard, I'll do things that are history, which I want to get as much of this and leave it on the board as I write so that you can look back and see where my intuition is coming and how we got these ideas. So the specific history for supernova was that, you know, you have a discovery time. A discovery time that was 185 AD, or maybe even earlier, but this is the first good record of one, at least by a lot of the history astronomers. And the instrument that they discovered it with was the eye. So you had a nice, good instrument discovering. I'm also, some of my biases, I'm a mechanism theorist from the start, so I try to ignore as many observations as possible. Second, I'm a supernova theorist first and foremost, so if I start making fun of the gamma ray burst theory or anything in gamma ray burst, remember my biases. So they were discovered with the eye, a nice good instrument. There's two primary models, so two models. There's the stellar collapse model, and here, this is where, note the, when we start doing the history, note the similarity. Stellar collapse models, two neutron star, and that was actually proposed in 1934 by Zwicky plus about a host of people. As soon as people realized you could make a star out of neutrons, everyone knew you could then get a lot of energy by collapsing a star down to a neutron star. And so there's people like Gamow, Landau, you know, just the whole group, Oppenheimer, all the guys that were working in the field all had papers roughly in the early 1930s, mid-1930s, suggesting these objects that people were seeing were caused by the collapse down to a neutron star. The other model was waited until about 1960, or at least the good paper that I like on it came in 1960. And this is, a thermonuclear model where you instead blow up a star through thermonuclear reactions. And so you do something where you disrupt the star entirely by thermonuclear actions. And that had to wait till people knew about nuclear reactions and knew them well enough to propose it. And that was 1960 by Hoyle and Fowler. And by the late 1960s, in the 60s, they started doing computational models of both of these. But first and foremost these, and then later these. So you had, at some point you were already, by the 60s, we were already doing computational models and working on this field. So that's supernova. We have two different kinds of models, and we'll see that both of these turn out to be right. These are the two primary models. Again, as a mechanism theorist, we throw out anything is not in the standard one to avoid confusion. So these are the two ones that were really vying for accuracy. And the funny thing was that there were, in the 60s especially, in the early 70s, there was one guy pushing this model and one guy pushing this model, and they had lots of papers that fought each other on which one was right. And it turns out both were right, just for different types of supernova. For gamma ray bursts, the discovery was much later, 1967, and the instrument were these Vela gamma ray satellites, so gamma ray detectors. These objects are just they can be discovered as energetic outbursts in the optical. These outbursts were discovered as energetic bursts in the gamma rays. And there's a story that I don't know if is right or not, but one that Sterling Colgate likes to tell, which is that these objects were actually predicted by the Russian bomb scientists prior to 1967, prior to the even idea prior to building these gamma ray satellites. These were built by Los Alamos. The satellites that did the discovery were called the Vela satellites. And they were built to make sure the Russians were following the test ban treaty that was being signed back then, which was on doing any kind of atmospheric tests. So they were worrying about atmospheric tests. They were built these satellites to check to see if the Russians were following that. The idea was that you would see the gamma rays from the burst and be able to tell whether they were running the tests or not. The issue that the Russian scientists, so Sterling Colgate was actually in Switzerland as the U.S. scientist advising the politicians on this particular treaty, and the Russian scientists came back, so says Sterling, and said, but you'll see gamma rays from the universe, from explosions in the universe. And Sterling argues that they predicted that you would see them from supernova. So the first tie of supernova and gamma ray bursts came even before the discovery of gamma ray bursts. And that was the Russians saying, well, you're going to get swamped. Your search for these atomic bombs is going to get swamped by supernova producing gamma rays. And it turns out that this was the first kind of model that Sterling Colgate came up with for gamma ray bursts, was from supernova. And he says he got the idea from the Russians prior to 1967. But now there's two primary models that we usually discuss. There's the stellar collapse, well, let's do in order. There's neutron star mergers, so it's the merger of two neutron stars. So we have double neutron star systems in the galaxy. The probably the most famous is the Hulse-Taylor pulsar system. So the merger of two neutron star stars, a neutron star binary, the merger of those two neutron stars will eventually form. They accrete together, and the idea is you're releasing a lot of potential energy and you can make a gamma ray burst. And this was proposed at least as early as 1986 by Paczynski. And then the second model, which is what we're going to focus on and what we're focusing most of this workshop on, is the stellar collapse to a black hole. And that was officially proposed in 1993 by Woosley. So you had these two competing models for these gamma ray bursts. And so you have now two models, but look, they're not being proposed that, they weren't proposed that recently. In fact, the first computational model of this kind of, this progenitor was not until 1999. So computational models, you're looking at something that's much less well studied. So you have something that's been doing computational models since the 1960s, and something that's been doing computational models since almost 2000. So one is we have over almost 50 years, and one is we're roughly less than 10 years. So you're looking at a 40-year difference in how long these have been studied. And you're going to see that when I start discussing the different mechanisms, how much different we understand these objects and what we kind of argue about. So these are the two kind of histories of these objects. And let me just tell you a little bit about what these explosions are. You know, what you'll get from a lot of our talks and where the arguments come on the kind of broad range of what these explosions look like. And the astronomers do the thing that you would expect them to do. They act like zoologists and they start typing the various objects. And that botanist, I guess, is a better way to say it. The botanist in these observers comes out and they start to just classify them into groups. And I want to give you some of the classification because otherwise you will never follow any of our talks because that comes really quickly. So the supernova has two main types. There's type 2. Yeah.
I'm a little puzzled by this assembly. Astronomers certainly knew black holes formed from stellar collapse. So was there a connection with gamma rays which came
in
the
90s? Yeah, so the issue was that the idea was that you... I mean, the reason you're asking why did this not come... There's a lot of models with black holes in them. The ones that actually fit the data best did not come till 1993. So this kind of collapsar model didn't come till 1993. There was lots of things where you had the idea of something collapsing into something else, like a white dwarf down to a neutron star. There was lots of these kind of models. It's just that this one that's now the favored model was not really proposed until 1993. So for the long duration bursts, and I'll get to this. By 1992, there was over 200 models. And they all involved things like collapsing something down to a compact object, and we'll go into why. I mean, that's the only place you're going to get the energy. So that's, you know, for a mechanism theorist, you don't have much as far as options. So supernova, there's a couple types. There's the type 2 supernova, and they're characterized by having hydrogen lines. So the reason they get... Their classification, the botany in them is that you see hydrogen lines in them. There's actually a lot of other features of them. These guys are also then split up into what they call differences in their light curves. So there's linear type 2L, which are linear light curves that go up and go down. Type 2 plateau, which are go up, then kind of stay steady for a while, and then go down. So there's different types within these. The main feature of type 2s is they all have hydrogen lines. Then there's type 1s, which are essentially those that do not have hydrogen lines. And 1A supernova then has silicon. 1B don't have the silicon, but they have helium. And 1C, who don't have either of these, and so they're the grab bag. And so you start, you're looking at, you know, that's the only thing that makes these criterion, although these all had features that made us think that these came from more compact stars than these. So there's also light curve reasons to think these are compact stars, these are not.
So A contains silicon and helium, B just helium.
So light curve people can tell me how strong the helium. I mean, these probably have, these have really whopping silicon lines that dominate the spectra. These have helium lines that are, you know, dominate the spectra, and these do not have helium. I don't know how strong the helium is in the. It must not be at all in the.
No helium.
Yeah, there's no helium at all in these. The other issue is that. What we're learning in this meeting is a lot of 1Bs have faint hydrogen lines. So, you know, this is a theorist, you know, use these as theorist features, but remember that, you know, when I say there's no hydrogen in this 1B, that doesn't mean there's absolutely no hydrogen. So these are the categories. It turns out that these objects and these objects, for a large number of reasons, we think are coming from the collapse of stars. So these are our collapse of stars objects. This is the thermonuclear explosion. So these two models, this one is this guy, and this guy gets all the rest. And that may change, and there may, I mean, who knows what's happening with some of these weirder 1Cs. But that's you know, these are all likely to be collapse of massive stars, but more compact stars than these hydrogen giants. For gamma ray bursts, it's even simpler. Gamma ray bursts were discovered as these emitting bursts of gamma rays, and they're divided simply based on their duration. So there's long duration gamma ray bursts, and they're short, and there's a possible category of intermediate, but at the level that I'm doing simplifications, we'll just have long and short gamma ray bursts. So they're really divided by their duration. The long ones are roughly greater than 3 seconds. The short ones are roughly less than 3 seconds. The short tend to have harder spectra. If you look at the energy from the gamma rays, there tends to be more high energy gamma ray emission than low energy, and the long ones are softer. So we call them the long soft bursts and the short hard bursts. And for a mechanism theorist, that's all we really care about. And the real issue that we care in the mechanism community is that these guys have a lot of gamma ray emission. And the way that people thought you were going to get the gamma ray emission was to say that you had very high Lorentz factors. And we now believe this very strongly, that these gamma ray bursts are produced by explosions that have very fast velocity expulsions. So you're looking at Lorentz factors of above 100, maybe up to 300, maybe even higher. But on the few hundred level is what the ejecta that's dominating these gamma rays is coming out at. So that's what, and in this case, in all the supernova, you're looking at a few tens of thousand kilometers per second. So these explosions are much less energetic than this. So from a mechanism theory point of view, you don't want to have, the reason there was a push to have black holes be the progenitor of one and neutron stars be the progenitor of the other is that you want the mechanisms to be different because the objects look different. These guys have a lot of relativistic ejecta, whereas supernova don't. So from the mechanism point of view, you wanted something that would give you lots of energy, but you have to have you have to have something different than your previous mechanism. So that's how we kind of got a couple different mechanisms for why there's two distinct mechanisms, I guess I should say, for these objects. So these are the, you know, so you have a little history of where these things started. Supernova started with much earlier, have had a lot more historical background, but in the end, their energetics are all the same. So the energy is just, you know, the energy reservoir I have is potential energy, so it's something like I have the core of some star and I can collapse it down to some radius, and the energy released is just the energy released that I'm going to have. So this is my energy released. It's just going to be the loss of potential energy that I, or the gain in potential energy I get as I collapse down. So This is the equation that we were, you know, that all you really have to know for supernova is where is the energy reservoir. And if you look at this and you say, well, I'm going to do a collapse of a massive star down to a neutron star, and remember that a neutron star that's hot, and that's what I'm going to collapse down to first, is going to have a radius of around 30 to 50 kilometers. Then if I ask what's the energy, that energy is going to be roughly g times the mass of the neutron star, where is roughly 1.4 solar masses squared over r of the neutron star, a proto-neutron star, because it's still hot, which is roughly 30 to 50 kilometers. And this energy is around 1 to 2 times 10 to the 53 Earths. So that's how much energy we have available. What they see in supernova is roughly 1 times 10 to the 51 ergs. And Hans Bethe named this the FO for, and this is worth knowing for anybody, it's 10 to the 51 ergs. So the FO was 51, so 51 erg is how he named the FO. And so we have the supernova energies were roughly 1 FO. So we have these 1 FO explosions, these 10 to the 51 erg explosions, and I have this reservoir. So in most of astronomy, people would have just said, okay, we're good. The efficiency of the energy is 0.01 or 1%. Anybody would give me 1% and I'm golden. I have my explosion and I'm done. As you'll see in a moment, the supernova theorists, because they had this kind of model done by 1960, they had to do something more, and that something more has made life very painful. So this 1% efficiency is actually quite hard to get. For a gamma ray burst, we had the energy released. Instead, I'm going to have something that's roughly a small mass black hole. So let's make this be a black hole that's roughly 3 solar masses, and then make this radius roughly the ISCO, which is roughly 10 kilometers. And then you're looking at getting on the order of a few times 10 to the 54 ergs. So now I suddenly have something that's more energetic. We like that. I mean, so theorists not caring really what the observations are, except that we somehow have to get very energetic explosions that are relativistic. So this is supposedly stronger. And especially at the time, so let me give you some of the history of how people were building this up. At the time, we didn't know where the bursts were localized. And that's actually why this model wasn't coming out that quickly, was that we saw the gamma rays, we couldn't localize the bursts. We didn't know if they were within the galaxy, whether they were outside the galaxy. As soon as we started to localize them, we found that they were outside the galaxy. And if they were isotropic explosions, you were looking at 10 to the 54 ergs or more of energy. And already that makes us a little bit scared, because we suddenly have to get efficiencies of 1.0 to make it work. And if we can't even get 1% after 40 or 50 years on the supernova, it's going to be hard to get 100%. So we immediately, with this mechanism and the isotropic energy explosion, said, well, they can't be isotropic, because if this model is going to work, they better be beamed. So we don't need as much energy, so we can reduce this efficiency. But you're still looking at, if I beam it, well, in fact, what you do is you beam it to 1/100th of the sky, and then I can reduce this efficiency to 0.01. And then if I were just a normal astronomer, let's make fun of cosmologists just for fun. If I were a cosmologist, I'd be done, because 1% efficiency, you'll give me any time, any day of the week. So that would be the picture. So the energies are the same. So we suddenly started to get back to similar physics again. We started off, we have these two different explosions. We have models that are fairly similar, just one's a neutron star and one's a black hole, but the energies we're getting, you know, we're going to tap somehow potential energy. And the only way to tap this energy is if we have some angular momentum. So that's kind of the different picture here, is that we have to have the object for the gamma ray burst to collapse down to a black hole, and it has to have angular momentum. So I was just going to go through briefly what the different mechanisms look like now at their current state, where, let's do the supernova one first. Here's the proto-neutron star. The picture we have at the moment is the star is crashing down on itself. The core goes down to a proto-neutron star that's roughly 30 kilometers. Above that core, you start to build up an atmosphere, and you have well above that core, maybe around 100 to 200 kilometers. Well, let's put it 200. If it's going to succeed, it's going to have to go eventually get out this far. You have the rest of the star crashing on in an accretion shock. So there's material falling in, it shocks, and in this region between the protoneutron star and that shocked region is an atmosphere. And that atmosphere, when it's first built, is actually has an entropy gradient that tells it it's unstable. So entropy is decreasing as I go out. So I essentially have a hot material below some cold material, and it wants to convect. So I have a convective region here. So this region is convective, and what we're doing with all of our, when people talk about the models that they do on core collapses, trying to model this or one other convective region, and that's in here. And here there's a convective region because the electron fraction, the lepton, in fact, the lepton fraction goes down as you go toward the surface of the neutron star. So if I looked at either the electron fraction or the lepton fraction, total lepton fraction, it goes down and then back up. This is probably more up like this. It goes down as a function of radius, where this is roughly at 30 kilometers. This is roughly where the neutrinos are no longer trapped. So in this core, neutrinos are trapped. They're not moving out. And they're leaking out of my protoneutron star. And there's a little gradient of a lepton. So what if you have something where you have light material, which are electrons, below some heavy material that are neutrons, it would want to convect too. So there's a convection in this region too. So this is, the model starts, it's only going to get worse. It gets messier. So I'm going to repeat this model several times because it's we keep on, this is what we do in the, since the 60s, we just repeat this model over and over, so I can just keep on repeating. We have a region where we have a protoneutron star, it's collapsed, it's emitting neutrinos. We have a region on top where the star is still falling in, preventing the explosion from happening. And in between that protoneutron star and that accretion shock is a convective region. Now, if this convective region can push out, we get an explosion. If it does not push out, we fail and we get a black hole in the end. So this determines the fate of the star, whether this convective region can win. And we're doing these simulations. And the question is, can the neutrinos deposit enough energy to drive the explosion? Or is it some... Right now, people have started to turn a different way. The idea is that the convection, the accretion of material, is driving sound waves that cause things like the neutron star to oscillate and then drive the explosion. So it's all accretion energy, not the neutrino energy. If you had asked 2 years ago, everyone would say neutrinos are the only thing you care about. Now, except for maybe me and maybe Thomas Yonka, but I'm not even convinced of that. Except for me, I think people have switched to a new paradigm where it's the accretion energy. But let's just say there's energy coming in. I'm accreting material on, and there'll be downflows in this convection, so there'll be material flowing down here, and they're going to that downflow will release potential energy, either via sound waves. Sound waves is the big thing right now, via some kind of sound wave instability. But there's also neutrinos leaking out, and somehow that has to drive the explosion. So that's where we're at now. That's the state of supernova. We're kind of working on how can all the physics that's involved produce an explosion after this result. And the I guess sad thing is that when we do these models, there's not one piece of physics that does that's so important that as long as you get it right, you can get all the rest of the physics wrong. So what happens is someone does a model, they do one piece of physics well, they do another piece of physics right, that either gives them the explosion or it doesn't. Then they tweak their model slightly, and then it changes their results. So this is the waffling back and forth between supernova theorists on whether we've solved it or not. The real issue is that there's a lot of physics here, and if it is this convection, we're not even close. If it's things like sound waves, we're not even close to having sophisticated enough models to do to actually model this. And that's where it's kind of the tragic part of this state of this field is that it looks like simulations really count, and if you actually are ever forced to believe simulations, it's kind of like believing a two or three sigma result from an experiment or an observer. If that's what your life is based on, that's a little scary. If your life is based on complex hydro simulations, that's also a scary thought. But let's just describe what the simulations have right now. So now the simulations, people are putting in complex equations of state to describe the how neutron star matter behaves. Not correct ones, but complex ones, nonetheless. And we know they're not correct. We just, the people that do, the nuclear physicists that do equations of state, it's really easy for them to do a complex equation of state with different combinations of quark matter or whatever, however they want to pasta. They can do it, but only if they assume zero temperature. And the problem is that temperature, it's not a degenerate-only situation here. The temperature of the protoneutron star is pretty high. So there's not that many equations of state out there for modeling this particular problem. People can do cold neutron stars with lots of different equations of state, play around with things, but we only have about... There's two that are commonly used. I think there's a third that's out there, but that's where we're at. We're at, you know, there's not much we can do, so we know the equations of state are not good, but we don't have anything better. GR has been used in approximation, so you can do approximations to put in the effects of general relativity. If you, well, I'll describe when GR has been done in detail. Neutrino transport is added, so you actually model how the neutrinos get out, and people do this in three species, where there's the neutrinos, the anti-electron neutrinos, anti-electron neutrinos, and then all the mu and tau neutrinos put together, because their opacities are roughly the same, so you can get away with just three species. And then there's a, we've done up to 3D in the hydro, so we've actually modeled the hydrodynamics up to 3D. So this is kind of what we've done and has been done. The issue is that someone uses a different transport scheme and they get a different result. In the case of the, I mean, and my bigger fear is, are we getting results that are now bizarre things of the hydrodynamics? Well, I don't trust any of the hydro techniques we're using yet. So that, I mean, we're doing it in 3D hydro, but we're using the standard hydrodynamic techniques. And if sound waves become important, that's something we should be afraid of in our results as well. So there's lots of simplifications here that I think we're still tracking down. Fortunately, at the lab, this is a thing. We have this thing called stockpile stewardship, and we're trying to we're playing a similar game. So I'm used to Quixote quests of Quixote anyway. So Don Quixote quests. So this is quite palatable to most of us brain-dead supernova theorists. The other thing that people have done is they've done GR in very good detail, where they've tried lots of different techniques of putting in GR, and maybe not to the detail of you guys that are working beyond four dimensions, but at least for us four-dimensional beings, it's okay. But there they then don't put in the complex equation of state, and they don't put in the neutrino transport. And so those models are really just tests. They can't really do the explosion. They're mostly trying to get gravitational wave emission. So this is what kind of where we are as far as the state of affairs for the explosions. And I would say there's not much that... There's maybe five major groups in the field doing this, and there's not much that we agree on. I think at the moment we agree, and this is something that is fleeting, so it may change, but at the moment we agree that this is an important region. And the only other thing I would say, that we agree on is that it's going to be harder to explode a more massive core. So as we go from low mass to higher mass, it's going to be harder to make an explosion. And why this is important comes back to the gamma ray burst model. The gamma ray burst model are those stars that this doesn't work on, because we have to form a black hole. If this explodes strongly, then we won't get a black hole. So the gamma ray burst models work on one of two ways. We have to form a black hole. Either the explosion here is weak, and then material falls back and makes a black hole, or this explosion doesn't work at all. So where we fail with this mechanism should be our only chance of succeeding for the gamma ray burst. And the gamma ray burst idea is the following. And now, I mean, I can describe you it quickly, because we really haven't done much, because we're, you know, well, I'm going to make fun of, I think I've worked on this field as much as most people, so I'm making fun of myself more than anybody, but we really haven't done much. What people do is the idea of the model is you have a black hole, So you have enough angular momentum to make an accretion disk, and then one of two mechanisms can make an explosion. One is, and this is the one that we pushed for a while, which is probably wrong, is, but somehow I'm going to say it because I pushed it, I guess, is that you have neutrinos and antineutrinos coming off the surface of this disk, and the neutrinos and antineutrinos can annihilate above the disk and deposit considerable energy and drive, you know, that's enough energy to drive an explosion. And that's certainly doable with the numbers are okay. And the advantage of this is we can actually calculate numbers. So but they're numbers with uncertainties. Usually there's, you know, a factor of 100 on either side. So we can get an energy value plus, I mean, times or divide by a factor of 100. But we can get roughly the energy from this. And the numbers seem okay. It's just that whenever you have a black hole and accretion disk, it's kind of screaming that you can get some kind of dynamo and make a magnetic field. And a magnetic, so the two mechanisms are this neutrino, antineutrino annihilation. And the other one is just magnetic field mechanism. And we know that at least for AGN, which are much bigger black holes and much smaller disks in comparison, the magnetic fields have to be the answer, unless someone's going to tell me there's a different one. But magnetic fields seem to be certainly the answer for active galactic nuclei, which are these 10 to the 6 solar mass black holes, 10 to the 8 solar mass black holes. Can we do the same with our 3 solar mass black holes? Well, what we've done so far in doing this study, there's one or two good papers probing this, but really not that much study in a computational way. And there's about 100 papers discussing various ways to make magnetic field strength very high and drive explosions with simple analytic guesses. And they get, of course, all different answers. And the real issue here is what you can always start to say, well, I'm going to get a magnetic field strength where the energy density is roughly equal to something like this. So this is what the game people play is. You're going to get some fraction of the energy in the disks in your magnetic fields. And then your magnetic fields will find a way to either take accretion energy from this disk or spin energy from the black hole and drive a jet. And this is probably the right answer. And my depression with that is that I went to a meeting not that long ago, it was here actually, where they were talking about mechanisms for active galactic nuclei, these 10 to the 6, 10 to the 8 solar mass black holes that I was mentioning. And in that case, they had Roger Blanford come and give a talk on the mechanism behind, the Blanford's Knight mechanism behind these active galactic nuclei. And his talk was pretty much, it was a blackboard talk, and I don't even think he drew anything on the board because he was waving his hands too fast to do this. You know, and maybe Omer can defend this more than me, but my fear is the following. I think they've, very smart people work on AGN, and it's still not quite solved. These smart people haven't moved into this field yet to do that kind of work, so we're still in the starting stages here. I go and beg these guys, John Hawley, these various guys that have been studying AGN for many years, please, please do this, you know, do this problem. No one's done it. You could do something that's complete nonsense, and it's better than what we have right now, so please do it. They don't. So right now we're not really that well solved in this field.
But all their calculations are scale free, so they have that for you.
The problem is that the equation of state physics starts to really play a role. It's even worse than that. What they really hate, they also hate the boundary conditions.
I can't happen to put photons in a simulation.
So this is the state of affairs. The boundary conditions are also different. So, in fact, this is the goal. Well, what are your boundary conditions? I start to describe it. And the issue here is we have, in this case, we have the star is falling in on this thing again. And so you end up getting, again, some kind of accretion shock that you have to blow off. And that's they like the boundary conditions of AGM where they can just, their boundary condition, I think they usually assume is they just put in material on the sides and there's not that much stuff coming down, raining down on them. And apparently, for these calculations. I don't understand MHD at all, but apparently that makes a that they can get a different answer, and I have at least found that out where I take a MHD code and try a different boundary condition, and it makes a quite different answer. So this is the state. This is the state of this field, which I would say we need a lot more work. What has been done so far is 2D hydro calculations with an equation in state that I thought was horrible, but was at least better than a gamma law, I guess. So it wasn't. It could have been. Could be worse. And there's been some test MHD calculations where the code wasn't really well designed for the problem, but it got some of the way there. So that's what's been done as far as here. And then if you just said I want to do a pure GR, collapses of or compact objects down to black holes, the GR community has been working where they, again, just assume a gamma law equation of state, but they try and do GR. There's people like Shibata, Luciano Rizzola, people like this have actually been doing calculations with pure GR. But that, again, won't help us solve the explosion mechanism problem. So these are the two mechanisms. And where they tie together and why we actually can have such a meeting where we bring the supernova and the gamma ray burst community together is it turns out that where this fails or is not very strong, this is when this mechanism has a chance to succeed. So that's the entire, from the mechanism theorist point of view, observations, the issue is that there was a, in 1998, there was a gamma ray burst with a supernova associated with it. To the mechanism theorist, that's not that exciting because if you blow up a star, it's going to look like a supernova. So it's going to have a supernova component to it, unless you somehow blow it up and don't produce any nickel. Or, you know, there's lots of things, but the issue for a mechanism theorist is the progenitors of both of these are stars. And so, yes, there's things that look like that, you know, if I blow up a star, it's going to have a supernova associated with it. But I've never liked to call the gamma ray bursts, the little blips of light in gamma ray bursts supernova, because they're, to me, a supernova is by the mechanism, and this is my neutron star mechanism is my supernova. This is something else. In fact, it's called a collapsar by some. What's happened in the recent time as far as, so this is all the mechanism stuff. This is all we have.
You want to make a few comments on acoustically powered events? Possibly.
Other than the fact that that's one of the things that we're worrying about, yeah, that's in there, but I don't want to say, you know, we have to understand this hydrodynamics to really tell that, and that's, yeah.
So in the collapsar case, why is it that you're looking at the situation where you already have a pre-existing black hole and you're not getting energy from the actual formation of the black hole?
Oh, not from the collapse when the neutrons are around the black hole?
Yeah.
Well, the flippant answer is that that's a lot harder to simulate than just accretion onto a black hole. So, yeah, I should point out that these simulations, and even what I'm doing now, is the black hole is modeled as a inner boundary that just lets anything accrete into it that can. The real answer is that when people do collapse down to a neutron star and black hole, I haven't seen them getting enough. They get a lot of gravitational wave energy. They don't get a lot of energy that we can put into an explosion. But you guys can tell me differently. You can tell me should we be. But we certainly haven't. People like, I mean, the people that are steering this are people like Stu Shapiro. And we go by what he. So he doesn't get. He's done collapses. Him and Thomas Bumgart have done collapses of neutron stars to black holes, and they don't see explosions coming arising from that. And the kind of advantage, well, I mean, so the, we do know this we can solve, and at least right now we haven't solved it, but this seems more easily solved, and at least the models by Stu Shapiro and his colleagues doesn't predict, but you can tell me whether you believe their assumptions.
Well, I'm not the right one to ask. But I'm curious if there's some simple explanation for the picture for why you aren't getting a lot of energy. You know, presumably if it's three guys in a truck, maybe a lot of it goes sort of down the horizon.
Yeah, so the idea is, at least when it collapses, there's not, that's the inner part of the star. It doesn't have as much angular momentum. So you're not going to form a huge disk of materials not falling in immediately. And if you look at a, I mean, here's one of the games that you can play, is you can look at a neutron star that is being pushed up to, you know, take your favorite equation of state, push that neutron star up to its maximum mass. And its radius, usually the issue is that its outer radius is not that much bigger, it's not that much bigger than the innermost stable circular orbit once it collapses down to a black hole for a black hole of the same mass. So you don't have a lot of mass out there that is going to help you get out that energy. So you're going to have to find a way to get that energy out. But, I mean, this is... So, we're not simulating... Well, they are. People like Shibata are simulating the collapse now. And they certainly get gravitational wave energy quite a bit coming out, but I haven't seen them... something we can convert into kinetic energy coming out. But that may just be simplistic models at this point. So people have not focused on that for those two reasons. One, it's easier to do this, and two, when people do just the collapse, they don't seem to get a lot of kinetic energy out. I just want to end with how we get back to, you know, this kind of connection. What made me feel good about it, and this has probably been a very bad reason to like it, is that if you look at a plot of... There's this other... So this mechanism is called... We call it the collapsar. That's the collapse down to a black hole. This is just the... It's called the delayed neutrino mechanism. Whether that name will stay, if neutrinos aren't important, is another thing. If these acoustic waves become important, then it'll change. So you have these two mechanisms. And we have gamma ray bursts, and we have just normal supernova. There's another class that's called hypernova. They're energetic supernova, and they may or may not, it may be that gamma ray bursts and hypernova are the same, they're the same. A hypernova that doesn't have gamma rays is just a hypernova. These are beam jets, so if the gamma ray burst is not beamed toward us, it may be that a hypernova is just a jet that's, we're not seeing the jet, but we're seeing the explosion. So we don't the high Lorentz factor jet is not beamed toward us, but we're seeing the disruption of the star. So hypernova could be the same as gamma ray bursts. They may be some continuous object that you have gamma ray bursts that are relativistic jets. If you somehow don't get a relativistic jet, but you still have an energetic explosion, that's a hypernova. So if I take that idea, these hypernova would be. And I'm going to be a simple mechanism theorist where I have two mechanisms and I have to throw hypernova into one of them. I would put hypernova along, the mechanism for hypernova along here with my mechanism for gamma ray bursts. And so I have hypernova over here, supernova over here, and I have these two mechanisms. The idea I would have if I went for more and more massive stars, so if I have a function here that's the mass of the star, I would expect the supernova mechanism to work for low-mass stars, and the reason is because the Rayleigh pressure falling in for a low-mass star is lower, so this is easier to explode. So it's easier for one to explode a low-mass star. So I would get supernova, and let's put energy, this could also be mass and nickel on this side produced. But if I have the energy of the explosion on this plot, and I asked what does this mechanism produce, it would be high, and then it would drop down. In fact, the idea is it would do something like this. The energy from just the supernova mechanism would go like this, and the reason it goes down beyond a certain mass is that it's just hard to explode these guys if there's a lot of Rayleigh pressure going up. So this is the kind of expectation we would have from this mechanism. The expectation from the hypernova, it's really an ansatz, we're assuming that it's somehow more energetic, would be that when I get this kind of mechanism, a collapsar, I get energetic explosion. So you expect something that's a kind of bimodal branching off of objects in the observation. So this is what you would expect from this simplistic picture. And the reason that gets me excited that maybe there's all this flows together is that, and this is actually a plot from Ken Nemoto, is that there's some supernova down in this category that are weak, and believe that when I put down this plot, realize that you shouldn't trust anything that I'm saying. If you trusted anything up to now, don't trust this plot at all. And you've already trusted me too much. There's some weak supernova along this plot, which I would argue are these guys that failed I didn't get a strong explosion, but I also didn't have enough angular momentum, or something was missing to make these objects. But we also have a whole set of hypernova, including gamma ray bursts, some that are gamma ray bursts, that are on this high branch. And that, you know, it seems to fit together. More massive stars are more likely to fail in this mechanism and produce this mechanism. And that's what the observations seem to be telling us, if you are very trusting in the observations. So this is how the supernova, in one plot, this is the connection between supernova and gamma ray bursts. Where the classic supernova mechanism fails, we may have a mechanism to make gamma ray bursts. And that is what I want to leave you guys with as far as this connection and the point of this workshop. The idea in this workshop is we're bringing people from both fields. A lot of people have worked in both fields. At some point they start moving over. But we brought people in both fields, and these are the mechanisms that we hope to be able to distinguish with all of the data that's out there. And that's when we start getting to the details of what's really happening where, what do we know about progenitors. But these are the two mechanisms that we're trying to argue about. And we'll do so for the next couple months. And I'll end there.
So how much energy is released in the hypernova?
Yeah, so originally, if you thought they were isotropic, then the energies were high, like 10 to the 54 ergs. But now it's getting down to 10 to the 52 within a few factor of a few. So it's because it's beamed. The issue is
I'm sorry, the gamma rays were beamed. The hypernova is invisible light?
Sorry, the hypernova is seeing invisible light. And the visible, it looks like the explosion was asymmetric. So the idea is the explosion was stronger along the pole. Presumably you have this jet that then drives a less relativistic ejecta along the poles. And so they're energetic, but they're not 100 times, you know, they're not 100 or 1,000 times more than a supernova. They're, you know, to me as a dumb theorist, they're about
to. But then the beam isn't pointing towards you. We don't see it at all.
Well, you still get an explosion. The whole star still explodes. In things like the radio, you still see, you would see something that is, the radio remnant will look different if it's, we'll get that whole energy budget. So this is where Sri Kulkarni, and I guess he's not here today, but Roger Sauvier was on some of their work, where they said, look, we're looking at the radio remnants of these, and this is how they should, you know, this is what they look like. And you can also see it in the spectra of these hypernovas. So you know, even if it's not, the fastest stuff is not pointed at you, you still have an idea of what the explosion energy is. And Ken Nemoto is probably one of the big guys doing this, so he is here somewhere.
Some other questions?
Just a remark. From the observations from the outflow velocities in these 1C type hypernovae, you get energies which are about 10 times larger than a normal supernova, isn't that so?
Yeah.
That's the kinetics, because the outflow velocities are so large, 40.
Yeah, but so this is... His question was, if I was seeing instead, I'm looking this way, and I'm seeing an explosion that went out this way.
From Mazzali, we have one case where we look almost perpendicular.
Yeah,
so still the velocity.
Yeah, so you still know it's energetic.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just, you're just not seeing the same Doppler. So he's just adding, we can tell when it's hypernova even if it's not pointed at us.
Could you clarify something? This mergers, I thought Sri was arguing was responsible for these short bursts.
Yeah. But I didn't talk much about these because these are really not. The reason I didn't is that for the connection between supernova and gamma ray bursts, it's really these, the long duration bursts, and these that are similar. We're not working so much on this workshop on the 1A models. These are the thermonuclear explosions, and we're still going to discuss these because the issue is the physics. The neutron star mergers, the basic picture is the same. You end up getting an accretion disk in a black hole, there's at least that's a lot of the simulations, that's what they calculate to calculate the energy. So these short bursts that were not localized until SWIFT really came in and started, essentially this summer, we started getting a whole set of localized torpors. The current favored model is the merger of two neutron star objects, and this is what we were believing anyway, simply because these guys form such a small disk, you expect them to be over quite quickly, and the collapse of a massive star takes a lot longer. So these guys, we thought, would probably be short bursts if we could do anything. There's a feature that makes it hard to believe these, and that's there's an X-ray flare on one of the short bursts that happened a few hundred seconds afterwards, and that poses a problem for this particular mechanism. But, you know, observational issues are not something that we mechanism theorists are supposed to worry about. So this is still the favorite model, I think, for these short bursts. And as far as physics goes, it requires the same physics as the collapsar model. So the same people that can do this model can do this. So as far as the mechanism guys go, we can kind of study both, although it's kind of split. There's a set of people working on these and a set of people working on these, mostly because there's so much work to be done that we don't have time to do both. But yeah, that's the short burst, and that's probably the most exciting stuff that's new this last year, was that SWIFT localized a whole bunch of short bursts, whole bunch being more than I can count on half a hand. So there's roughly five that are well localized in my mind, and then that brings on makes it so we can study these. Until this year, we didn't know where these guys were located. So we didn't know how much energy really was there. We just knew that they had more than a certain amount of energy because we didn't think they were in the galactic plane. But we didn't really know much about these guys until we localized them. So this is a new object that, even though our meeting is not really focused on this, we will still talk about it a lot because it's the new hot topic. We suddenly got more data.
Just a correction. First, it was suggested 12 years before, so in the early 70s, two Russian guys, Ushov and Chibyshev.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking it had to be earlier than this, because this is... I just didn't see it on the little list of models by... who was it? The 92 paper that had the 200 models on it.
And so far, we have only five or six short bursts localized.
Yeah.
We need more data.
Are there any wild thoughts about other forms of matter, dark matter, that might enter this game and influence?
Well, certainly there was a whole bunch of colliding string models for gamma ray bursts initially, but those have all, they're no longer studied in that much detail anymore. An issue with astronomy, maybe it's a good thing, we're very much, once we like a thing, like... Certainly, I was with the group that was working on these models, and we do not like this model as much as I think the astronomy community does. So it's good if people work on different mechanisms. And so, for a while, it was thought that maybe these primordial black holes could produce them. Anybody that's interested, send me an email, and I'll send you some of the papers of the lists of all the mechanisms that were proposed. I kind of ignored all those and just got the ones that are somehow became the favored, rightly or wrongly. But certainly there's a whole bunch of mechanisms for these that are proposed and still being proposed. So, I mean, new mechanisms for the short burst instead of this neutron star merger thing are still coming out. And we had a talk last week by Neil Garrels supporting one of the alternate mechanisms. A thing for just a highlight for what's happening this week is we're actually going to talk about the progenitors of both these objects, and that should get us a little bit further along on what we're studying. So we have two discussion sessions this week exactly on what are the progenitors of these guys and what are the progenitors of these guys.